Hello and welcome to another Linguistics CareerCast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Sarah Hendry has a background in psycholinguistics, cognitive science, and discourse analysis, how language works in the brain and how we interact with each other to get our meaning across. She also has an MBA from Temple University. Her employment in the pharma and healthcare industries as a linguist has given her deep subject matter expertise from experience working in over a dozen therapeutic areas across audiences and challenges. She has also co-authored medical journal articles on effective communication. Topics discussed include sociolinguistics, discourse analysis, language strategy, qualitative research, quantitative research, MBAs, patient communication, publishing, AI, and salary negotiation. Links to Sarah's LinkedIn and other resources are in the show notes. If you think you'd be a good guest on the show, or you'd like to recommend a linguist for me to interview, please fill out the contact form on the website at linguisticscareercast.com. And if you'd like to support this show, we've got a Patreon. Our premier patron is the fabulous Lingthusiasm podcast, hosted by Gretchen McCullough and Lauren Gaughan. That's about linguistics as a way of understanding the world around us. If you're not listening yet, you really should be. So I would like to welcome to the podcast today, Sarah Hendry. Thanks for being on the podcast, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about your career, which spans a couple different places, and you have an MBA, which is also really interesting, and you're in the healthcare field. But first, the first question that I always ask people is, how did you find out about linguistics and decide that that was going to be a thing that you studied in your career?
You know, it is funny how little I knew about it as an option before going into college. I think that's probably true for a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. I entered undeclared and had no idea what I wanted to do. I actually applied for a dual degree program in international studies and business. I've always had an interest in foreign language. I studied Spanish in high school and did some immersion programs, and then studied Mandarin through college as well. Mm-hmm. So I was excited and interested in the like foreign relations stuff. I did not get into that program, so I ended up just in the General College of Arts and Sciences. And for the first 2 years, just kind of took classes that were of interest to me. Turned out when I was looking for a major that a lot of the classes I took had fulfilled requirements for the cognitive science major with the specific focus on language and mind. So I kind of just fell into it, but then mm-hmm. realized that my interest in foreign language actually has a lot to do with my interest in just communication as a general field of understanding. So finding that connection between like neuroscience, psychology, and linguistics was exactly right for me. It was really exciting.
Oh, cool. So your major was it, I'm looking at your LinkedIn and it says cog sci and linguistics. So was that like a double major, or cog sci was a specialty of linguistics?
Yeah. So technically my degree is in cognitive science with the focus in language and mind. So it's essentially a psycholinguistics degree. Mm-hmm. And then I have a minor in just linguistics. So I took a bunch of linguistics classes as well, in addition to the like cognitive science stuff around it.
Okay, cool. And what did you think you were going to do with that?
I don't know. I don't know what I thought I was going to do. I just was like, this is really cool and I'll figure it out. My parents were concerned that I would never get a job. Mm-hmm. They had never heard of cognitive science or linguistics. I had interviewed, let's see, right after school, I interviewed for a job with the CIA to do translation work. So I had studied abroad in China and got like pretty proficient in Mandarin at that time. No longer, but at the time could read and write pretty well. Luckily, I did not get that job. I think I would be a very different person if I had gone into government work. Mm-hmm. You know, for better or worse, I think it's nice to be where I am. But I landed in the field that I'm in specifically because I didn't get that job. And I was searching for just linguistics jobs in Philadelphia where I was living. Mm-hmm. And I found one. So I applied there. And it worked out. But I don't know what I thought I was going to do. I think I just wanted to learn and figured that something would come to me, perhaps.
Okay. So what was that job?
I started my career at Verilog. which does physician-patient dialogue research. Mm-hmm. So it's a sociolinguistic sort of job, like in the industry. I was very excited to learn that that's a thing that exists. I got a job as an intern, and then a full-time position opened up pretty quickly. So I just kind of moved into that. But they record conversations between doctors and patients and then hire linguists to analyze those conversations. Mm-hmm. So I was doing a lot of kind of dynamic understanding, kind of relational dynamics, turn-taking, the kind of questions that patients and doctors are asking, who's taking up most space, like what happens when a caregiver enters the room, how does that change the dynamic? Mm-hmm. But then even down to the specific lexicon of what patients are using to describe their symptoms or how physicians are describing different treatment options was incredibly fascinating and so cool that there were so many aspects of what I had studied in linguistics that applied directly to what they were asking me to do in my job.
Mm-hmm. Verilog's great. I know there's lots of linguists who have gone through Verilog, some who are still there, but lots of people who have gone through and done other things. And it's so great that they have a reputation as hiring actual linguists, right? Yes. Like not just anybody. They really want trained linguists who are there to do exactly the kind of work that you're talking about, like discourse analysis and things like that.
Yeah, it was fabulous. I got to a point after about 2 years that listening to lung cancer diagnosis conversations was one of my last projects, and listening to like multiple hours of people be diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer got to be a little too much for me. Mm-hmm. Very important work, I think, but I think that's probably a reason why people don't stay there forever is just mm-hmm. the burden of, you know, being an empathetic person, I think, tends to coincide with linguistics. I think there are a lot of overlaps with, you know, wanting to understand the perspective and perception of another person that come along with it. And so it becomes challenging at a certain point to be putting yourself in that position, listening to a lot of that pain and suffering, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to go back for a second. So that was just through applying for it cold, or was there something? So there was no networking involved. You just applied.
No, I got very lucky with that one. The rest of everything has been networking related, but that one I just happened to get lucky that they were looking for someone with the skills that I had as an entry level person.
Okay, cool. And then what happened after that?
I had a client at that company talk to us. She had mentioned a different company that she had been working with called Ms. Lansky and Partners that mm-hmm. does language strategy. And I had never heard of language strategy before. Turns out the reason is because Ms. Lansky and Partners made that up. So they're the only company that does it. But it just sounded so incredibly cool that I had to look into it. And that's, you know, where I went next. I was there for about 5 years. They do... language strategy is essentially strategic communications consulting. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of like message writing and focus group feedback on those messages. A lot of like sort of strategic language shifts. One of the projects that I think of is, I think for Starbucks, they were doing, it was when they introduced the like Via instant coffee packets. Mm-hmm. They weren't selling as well in the US as they expected. And turns out it's because when Americans hear instant coffee, we think that's going to taste like trash.
Yes.
So people weren't purchasing it. So the recommendation instead was to call it Starbucks coffee in an instant, which is the same thing, but it feels so incredibly different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the whole premise of what they do. Their tagline is, it's not what you say, it's what they hear. Mm-hmm. So it's all about communication dynamics and understanding how your message is going to land from the perspective of another person, mm-hmm. which obviously there are so many parts of linguistics that are involved in that. And I met quite a few colleagues at that company who had master's degrees in linguistics from Georgetown and other places as well. Mm-hmm. They hire a lot of linguists.
That's so good. And it's an area that I'm really big on linguists working in. Like my field is branding and marketing. And I, mm-hmm. I think marketing is perfect for linguists who are interested in this kind of stuff because it's all about language, right? Marketing is language. Yeah. And who better to look at it and decide what's going to be most effective, or even just to do the analysis of the kinds of language that's going to be most effective than linguists. Like every marketing company should have a bunch of linguists who are working there who can actually look at it and come up with the right recommendations, or just look at the way people are using it to understand what's going to be most effective. It's incredible to me that people don't do that. First of all, hire more linguists, but that they don't like do the right kinds of customer research and pose the questions in a way that's going to actually get you the right answers, right? Like, you know, because you've done this kind of stuff. You have to ask questions super carefully to get good data.
You really do. And that has aligned well with what I'm doing now. I took a brief stint outside of the healthcare kind of marketing field, but I landed back into marketing insights, and I'm writing surveys now, which is a little bit different. The quantitative data is different to work with than the qualitative data that I was working with at Ms. Lansky, but the premise is incredibly similar. You know, you have to ask questions in the right way to get the data that you want. You have to then understand how to analyze the answers appropriately. But then we also do quite a lot of like qualitative interviewing and a lot of open-end responses. And there's quite a significant amount of language coding that goes into that. Mm-hmm. Understanding how to conduct a corpus analysis, for example, is something that's incredibly valuable in this field. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And all of that for linguists anyway, just comes out of like the projects that you did when you were getting your degree, right?
Exactly.
Like, that's what you do.
You come into the field with those skills pre-baked, where a lot of folks who don't have that training have to learn it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you got an MBA.
I did.
And how did that happen? Like, why'd you do that?
great question. I think it's kind of similar to how I fell into the linguistics field. I knew that I wanted to get a master's degree, but wasn't sure what I wanted to study. I mean, I do know what I want to study, but I wasn't sure what would be the most financially effective for me. Realized that an MBA would be valuable in any field I went into. So it felt like the right way to kind of continue my understanding of specifically marketing dynamics, but also using my communication skills in a human resources capacity. Those were some of the elements of the MBA that I really enjoyed most, and it feels incredibly complementary. It seems surprising, I think, when I think about it, being a linguist with a master's degree, but they really do, or a master's degree in business, they really do kind of align with each other quite well.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. First, congrats on getting an MBA. Not an easy thing to do, especially at Temple, which is a great school. I really wanted to see how you felt like linguistics intersected with the MBA. So in my business, my two partners at my company both had MBAs, and I was the linguist, and I felt like there was a lot of crossover in some of the things that they did. Obviously, MBAs, you know, there's a lot of profit and loss and things like that, which have nothing to do with linguistics, but the language part of it is all crossover, because a lot of it is marketing stuff and a lot of it is just learning what labels go on certain things and how to correctly categorize things. That's a big part of MBAs, is like, what is the name for this thing and how does it fit into the bigger picture? So do you feel like having a linguistics degree maybe gave you a little bit of an advantage in the MBA program?
I do think so. I mean, I think my brain was already trained in exactly the way that you were describing, Laurel, and like taxonomies, trying to understand how things fit in different places. And I think the benefit too is that I had the experience and knowledge from the linguistics background of understanding that framing is everything. So it's also, it's both feeling like I had some of those kind of ways of thinking that helped me understand what they were telling me in a business context was helpful. But then on the other end, I also feel like I came out with a lot more valuable skills, specifically because I had the linguistics background and understanding of how to communicate those concepts. It's one thing to understand multiple things, and it's another thing to know how to translate that to multiple audiences. And I think the linguistics training is the part that makes that easier and has been of the most value in every role that I've had at every company.
Wow, that's great. So were you taking a break between jobs when you were doing that MBA, or were you doing it at the same time you were working?
I was doing it at the same time, which was not something I would recommend necessarily. It did take me 4 years. So, you know, I took my time with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was doing it part-time while also transitioning from working at Verilog to Ms. Lansky and Partners, and transitioning from a in-person part-time MBA to an online part-time MBA. It was a big undertaking, but it was exciting to finally finish.
Wow, that's amazing. And then once you'd finished, did you feel like having that MBA was going to give you a big career boost, like in terms of opportunities, in terms of salary, in terms of just places that you could go or roles that you could fill?
I think so. I mean, immediately, not necessarily, because I stayed in the job that I had for the next couple of years. But then I do think it helped me kind of launch into where I am now. I'm leading a full franchise team at Spherix, which does physician survey data primarily. We're a syndicated independent market research company. Most of my peers are probably, I think all of my peers are at least 8 years older than me in this position. And I am quite sure that the linguistics training made me very capable to do the analytical part of the job. And then the MBA kind of pushed me ahead in terms of having the ability to do the like part of running the business that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I get to do both now, and I would not have necessarily been able to get there for a few more years if I didn't have the business training.
Interesting. It's something that we talk with people about a lot, right? Like, so you get your bachelor's degree, and then a lot of people go on to get a master's degree. And then there's always a huge question, like, what do I do after that?
Yeah.
Should I get the PhD? Should I do something else? Should I just go out there? And I think getting an MBA or any kind of business degree, because there's a lot of options out there, is not something that most people consider. But more and more, given the state of employment these days, looking to get some kind of professional business training might actually be a better option than a PhD, especially if you're not doing something that requires a PhD, right? Like there's some jobs where you absolutely have to have a PhD in linguistics. But I, from my point of view, having really good professional business training really does give you that leg up into the higher paid roles and the more responsibility roles, because then you, as you said, you know the framework, right? You know how things operate, and you don't have to be trained in any of that stuff. You come with the knowledge already.
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't realized so much how valuable the business degree was until I got into the role that I'm in now. But it is clear that having those two skill sets together is very differentiating. I find when I am in rooms with people and I mention that I have a linguistics background, they get very excited and they want to know more. So they don't meet that many linguists in the space that I'm in now. But it's clear that the skills and background that I have is of significant value to the industry that I'm in, which just, you know, it's exciting when people are also excited. They're like, oh, I don't know that I've met a linguist before. Tell me more about what you're doing. So the fact that there is so much excitement on the part of, you know, my colleagues and my peers and other parts of the industry just means there's ample opportunity for folks who have those skills and want to be exploring these opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great crossover. I agree with you. It's been sort of the same for me, like, especially when I was starting out, a lot of MBAs don't meet many linguists. And conversely, you know, a lot of people in linguistics don't get to work with MBAs that often. So it's nice to have different skill sets that you can share with different sets of people, which is really cool. So you were working at Maslansky, and then what happened after that?
I went to briefly a nephrology startup that was working through a Medicare program. I happened to, this was through a connection. It was my undergraduate class president in college, actually, was like co-founding this company. He is now the director of innovation at CMS. So he's kind of gone off to do other cool things. But I was very interested specifically to use my skills in physician-patient communication to help them build a patient experience program. So I actually reached out to him directly on LinkedIn and told him, I have a linguistics background and business training, and I think that these two things together would be of huge value to your company. And that turned into an immediate opportunity that I got to lead the patient experience team at that company for a couple of years.
Wow.
I unfortunately got laid off just because of Medicare stuff. They didn't have funding for that team anymore. But it was as a direct relation of both the connection that I had made through college, but then also specifically the way that I was able to articulate the value of having linguistics background and specifically physician-patient dialogue experience. I was then able to build the like welcome materials for patients and start up the Patient Family Advisory Council and kind of help them create their patient communication program in a really empathetic and person-centered way.
Wow, that's great. Talk about making your own opportunities, right? Like that's amazing.
It was great. I'm actually speaking with the my prior boss from that company this afternoon just to check back in. He's now the chief medical officer at Cigna and is looking for a senior advisor of communications. So that's an open opportunity at the moment, I think.
It's just, I'm thinking about all these different jobs that you've had, and it's so good to hear that there are so many companies who are willing to put that much time and effort and money into their patient communications, given how many examples we see of really bad patient communications. I mean, you see it all the time, but knowing that there are so many places that really do want to communicate with their patients effectively, because bad communication has real effects, right? Like it leads to really bad actual health outcomes.
Truly poor outcomes, yes.
Yeah. So it's heartening to see this, and I hope it's a trend that actually continues in different ways, especially in the United States. I've talked about this with some of the other folks who work in the same place you do. As this country becomes more diverse, which it's going to, like no one can stop that, and people speak different languages and have different cultural expectations as they interface with the healthcare system, you have to accommodate them. Right? Like you can't just assume that everybody's going to interface with a doctor in the same way or the healthcare system in the same way. So in addition to just doing it in English, you're going to have to do it in other languages and take into account how people behave when they're speaking with their physicians or their specialists, right? Like every culture has different ways of communicating, and we need to acknowledge that it's going to be different. We have to do something about it.
Yeah. There are companies now that are focused on that. I'm sure you're aware of them. Mm-hmm. There's one that I had wanted to work at. They didn't have any openings when I was looking, but it's called Violet. They do specifically, their whole focus is personalized, culturally competent care. And they provide training for physician groups. I know they've worked with like Rocky Mountain Health Plans and other parts of the United Healthcare ecosystem, where they help personalized care, but also provide training for providers to communicate with their patients in a more personalized and culturally competent way. The fact that these programs exist and that large companies are taking advantage of them, I think, is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, you think about how many linguists would love to do that kind of work, right? Like that's the dream.
And I think those opportunities exist too. So I think those folks can be doing that work, which is incredibly exciting.
Yeah. So cool. Okay. So back to your timeline. By the way, what's nephrology?
Oh, that's a kidney disease.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Yeah, of course. So we were working with chronic kidney disease and dialysis patients, which is a largely Black and brown population and often underserved. So it was especially exciting for me to be a part of work that was supporting a group of individuals who both needed additional healthcare resources, but also especially and particularly deserve to be communicated to in an appropriate way. So it was exciting to be part of that.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. Okay. So, and then what came after that?
Unfortunately, being laid off was very disappointing. I liked working there quite a lot, but you know, with government programs, stuff happens. So then I ended up at back in pharma, working at DDB Health. It's an advertising company. I was there for about 9 months, not a very long time, doing brand strategy. So I was their head or a VP of brand strategy for a couple of CAR T brands in blood cancers. So doing branding and brand strategy specifically, which I think, you know, we had talked about, that's a lot of what you have done as well. There's a lot of opportunity for linguists in that field. Since everything having to do with advertising is ultimately coming down to the message, whether or not it's verbal, there are still, you know, lots of kind of analytics and kind of communication principles that come into play there. And then the client communication part of things too, you have to be good at.
How was it working at an advertising agency versus working at a medical healthcare type agency?
Yeah, it was not for me personally. I think it could be for someone else. The pace was not quite for me. I feel like we were doing work that didn't feel as meaningful just for me personally. I love research. So it just felt like I wasn't learning as much as I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. Being able to provide strategic recommendations is always very exciting, but I didn't feel as comfortable doing it without the basis of a very deep, research program behind me, like I've done in the past. So for that reason, I'm happier to be where I am now. But yeah. I mean, the company does great work. Just mm-hmm. being in advertising was not my vibe, I think.
Yeah, totally. I know this well. But I have the experience of working at a big place like that, or one of the other large branding agencies, marketing agencies like Siegel Gale or Interbrand or Lippincott, is often a really good experience for linguists who are just getting out of graduate school and looking to get some experience, because they have a lot of entry level jobs, which at least give you some exposure to what it's like. And then you can figure out, do you like it or do you not like it? And you can gain some good experience if that's the kind of thing that you're interested in. So I often will recommend that people look at those kinds of giant places, because they go through people so quickly, right? I'm sure that yeah. happened in your department too. Like they just churn through people all the time.
Yeah, they're always people are moving around. There's new opportunities. Yeah, I know a couple of people who work at Interbrand and other related places, and mm-hmm. they love it. And they're also linguists.
Yeah.
And I know those companies always have opportunities. Like you were yep. saying, they're hiring people all the time.
Yep. And they have offices everywhere. So, around the world, around the country, big cities, even some small cities. So if you're interested in that, if you're a linguist and you're interested in that as a career, that's a great place to look. Even if you're right out of school and you've just gotten your bachelor's or your master's, they even have some internship programs too over the summer. Mm-hmm. So it's an excellent way to get some experience.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree with that. I think it wasn't quite right for me and mm-hmm. where I was in my career, but it would have probably been a very different experience if it was something that I had done right out of school. Mm-hmm. There are so many different places that a linguist could land too. I think copywriting is certainly a clear match, but even copy editing, I think, is a huge one that goes overlooked. It doesn't necessarily sound as exciting, but I think it is very exciting for someone who's deeply analytical mm-hmm. And wants to be thinking about ways to, make small tweaks to make large impact on how the message is received. I think editors can have a huge, huge impact that, we don't always necessarily appreciate, because they may or may not be the ones creating the content, but they're ultimately the ones responsible for the content being successful.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about any kind of brand, there's so many places where language touches people, right? Like mm-hmm. it's in the advertisements, it's on the website, it's on the instruction manual that might come mm-hmm. with something. It's everywhere, and every single word that's in there has to be touched by somebody at the company and looked at and considered and made sure that it's consistent with the brand and that it really conveys the thing you want to, and it's consistent with, whatever the vision is that it's supposed to be for the company. And to do it right takes a lot of work. And again, I think linguists are really, really good at that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Much better than, not to put down English majors, but I think linguists are just better at it.
An English major, right? Yeah. Like the point of an English major is to analyze language in a very different way.
Yeah.
And I think, there is obviously a lot of value to that, but it's a very different value.
Yeah. I think understanding how to do discourse analysis is like the best thing that you can know how to do if you're interested in doing branding, because it yes. kind of comes down to that.
I mean, everything in branding and advertising is a conversation. Just
yeah.
because the respondent isn't necessarily in front of you and replying, they're replying through their actions. So it's still a back and forth conversation. And the way to influence action is to have your part of the conversation feel appropriate mm-hmm. And to connect. So yeah. really everything in advertising and communications is discourse analysis, I think, mm-hmm. ultimately.
Yeah, no, totally agree. That's such a great way to look at it. Okay, cool. So back to you.
Yeah.
So you were at DD&B for a while, and then I do want to get to talk about this progression, this career journey that you've had, but let's finish up to where you went after that.
Sure. So that was pretty recent. I landed where I am now 1 year ago and 3 months. So I haven't been here that long, but mm-hmm. I love it. I actually got recruited to work here. So I heard from a recruiter who reached out to me about a role open at Spherix. And that was through a different connection. It was a client that I had had at Ms. Lansky and Partners that we worked very well together. Apparently, Spherix had been asking their client network if they had any recommendations, and she said that I would be a good fit. So they tossed my name over, and I got an email. So that was very exciting. So that also shows that having those good communication skills with your clients can lead to things as well. So yeah, they reached out to me and they were looking for someone to lead their hematology oncology team to start a new team in that space. I had had some experience working in that area. At Ms. Lansky, I did a project that actually turned into a scientific publication in the Journal of Rare Diseases on the gene therapy lexicon in hemophilia. I actually have two scientific journal publications based on linguistics topics, which is
awesome.
Really cool.
That's so cool. Yeah,
we can,
amazing.
We can talk about that too if you want. But yeah, this one, since I had that experience in hemophilia and then working at DDB was working in blood cancers, I had enough experience. So I just kind of landed here. But yeah, Spherix is we're doing mostly quantitative market research, which is a new area for me. But I have realized that most of it is linguistics anyway.
What does the so your title is franchise head? What does that mean?
Basically, we're a one company that has multiple therapeutic area focused teams. Uh-huh. So we all kind of report into the same insights team, but my team, I have three folks that work under me. We work only on hematology oncology.
Okay.
So I'm responsible for creating the vision of the team for the year. We do syndicated work. So I create the publication plan in advance, aligning with what we think is going to be happening in the market and what our clients might be interested in. So I'm responsible for kind of creating the year over year publication plan vision. As well as, you know, maintaining methodological excellence and, you know, driving forward like better insights creation on the team. But my job is also partially just to know everything there is to know about hematology oncology to the degree that I can.
That's a lot. That's a whole lot. So how much of your job is doing your job, the stuff that you were just discussing, like setting things up, and how much of it is just like keeping up on the literature and reading?
Probably half and half, really.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's, you know, it's casual. A lot of the catching up on literature and reading happens kind of passively. I have a lot of like email digests and stuff that come to me. We just got back from ASCO, the American Society for Clinical Oncology annual meeting. We had a poster presentation there. I'm also headed to EHA, the American Hematology Association meeting next week, and we have two posters there as well. So we go to a lot of conferences and congresses to be learning about the scientific stuff. And then I also just get things in my email inbox, and then my team is keeping up on things as well. So between all of us, we think we have a pretty good handle on it. And then the other half of my time is involved with like project work, but I also do have some sales responsibilities too. So right now we're in the process of trying to sell the work that we've done.
Sure. Yeah. So it sounds like you have many and varied responsibilities in your job.
Yeah. I think the way that they set it up here, I'm essentially running a full business with a complete P&L, but I then have the backing of the larger company from like a production kind of timeline and management standpoint. They do a lot of the like operations work centrally, but then each individual team is essentially its own franchise.
Oh, that sounds really good.
It's cool. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it sounds great. So yeah, I'm really interested in the publication thing. So this is, gosh, I talked about this on a previous interview that I had with someone. I was in a meeting with it was at Berkeley, and it was a career day kind of thing. And we were talking with the students about careers and options outside of academia. And one of the students said something like, once you get out and you have a career in industry, how do you cope with the fact that you're not a linguist anymore?
Oh.
And we were all like, what? And
you're a linguist forever.
Well, that's the that's what we were trying to express. But I understood what they were getting at, right?
Yeah, like
if,
of course.
The academia teaches you that if you're not in academia, you're not a linguist anymore. And part of that is publications, right?
Yeah.
If you're not publishing in language, or in one of the other journals that's associated with, you know, academia, it sort of makes you feel like you're not, you can't call yourself a linguist anymore, which is like, it's garbage. Of course you're a linguist. You studied linguistics, you know, yeah, this stuff. But I think if you can say that you're still publishing, as you were just talking about, it at least, you know, it helps a little bit to ground yourself and say, like, I'm still doing it. You read, right? Yeah. You're keeping up on the literature. So tell us about the publications that you've had.
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to be published at both Verilog and Meslansky and Partners scientific journals. So at Verilog, I think it was the Journal of Pain Medicine, we were doing a project with a client on opioid-induced constipation. They were interested in understanding the symptom burden on patients to be able to elevate the need for treatment potentially. And so we did a physician-patient dialogue project with them, and they thought the outcome and output of that was meaningful enough, and that they had the opportunity using that data in a meaningful enough way to put it forward in a larger forum. So we worked with their medical writing team to get it submitted and had the article published in, it's a full paper in the Journal of Pain Medicine, I think. Mm-hmm. I think I was the second author on that, perhaps. And then similarly, at Meslansky and Partners, we were doing a project for a gene therapy product in hemophilia. And they were interested in understanding how to create a lexicon that's patient-friendly, mm-hmm. knowing mm-hmm. that gene therapy is incredibly complicated, but that also patients are hugely involved in the rare disease space and deserve to be involved in shared decision-making. So we did a large scale kind of global research project to align on one lexicon for how you talk about gene therapy. And they thought that topic was meaningful enough to put forward. So similarly, we worked with their medical team to create something for submission and got published in the Orphanet Journal of Rare Diseases. So they're not linguistics publications, mm-hmm. but I have been published in medical journals, which is very cool.
Oh, but they're linguistics articles published in medical journals.
Yeah, the first one is on the physician-patient dialogue and patient symptom burden explanation. And the second one is looking at specifically lexicon creation.
Yeah. Oh, those sound so interesting. That is so cool. Proof. I mean, not that we needed it, but proof that you can still be doing research and you can still be doing actual real linguistics and getting published in other peer-reviewed journals in other fields, if it's in, you know, where the intersection is of whatever that field is in linguistics, and it absolutely counts. That's amazing. That's so cool.
Yeah, I actually saw just the other day there have been two other similar articles published on the lexicon in hemophilia since. So it's clearly, you know, a large and important topic, kind of how do we talk about these new novel therapeutics and potentially curative options like gene therapy. I think Meslansky and Partners, where I worked, they've published another one in partnership with a different client. And then I saw it might have been the World Hemophilia Federation or something like that, who just published another one on the lexicon of gene therapy. So it's clearly a topic that is of high importance and value. And the medical community does seem to be focusing on conversation dynamics and language in a much more focused way than I've seen in the past. I've been in the field for just over 10 years now, so not that long, but it has changed significantly even in that time, I feel like.
Yeah, that's great. Wow. I'm so impressed. That's so cool. I'm wondering, maybe you don't have an opinion on this, but I wanted to ask you anyway. In your particular field, do you see strategies and tools being developed to deal with the influx of companies trying to push AI tools on providers and healthcare companies?
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation with a doctor about this the other day at ASCO, actually. So, I mean, my company is obviously including AI in what we do, but the way that they are positioning it feels appropriate to me. I'm kind of questioning the value of AI personally. You know, I think there are a lot of things we can do with it, but it does take away from a lot of other things, including the environment. But I do feel like the companies that I've seen that seem to be doing it well are not necessarily planning on reducing their workforce. But we, for example, are looking at upskilling our workforce, knowing that AI may help us do a lot of the kind of lower level tasks mm-hmm. that folks don't want to be doing as much. Mm-hmm. We're putting in a lot more effort in things like kind of enterprise-wide thinking and strategic organization and things like that, so that the members of our team who are in more entry-level positions have those like people skills, soft skills sort of value. Mm-hmm. I think those soft skills are going to be, I mean, they've always been incredibly important, but I think they will be even more important in terms of like how to position yourself as a true partner to the organization mm-hmm. and someone who can use AI to benefit the job as opposed to AI taking away the job that you might do.
Yeah. I from what I have seen, like we on this podcast and in this part of linguistics generally, there's a lot of concern about how AI is being, I want to say, forced into healthcare because, yeah. Well, I'm sure you know this, of course, but it's so hit or miss, and the misses are incredibly damaging where it does miss. I'm sure you've had this experience, but I have played around with using some AI tools to like summarize transcripts and conversations mm-hmm. and it's garbage. Like it doesn't work. Yeah. And so when doctors are using it to summarize conversations between patients and healthcare providers, how can you ever think that it's going to be accurate? Because if it's just missing stuff in a normal summarized conversation, mm-hmm. how is it going to ever pick up the important things between you and your doctor when those things can be so subtle, right? Yeah. Like that's what you have done throughout your career, is to pick up on those subtle things and show how important those are. AI is not going to do that.
No.
You know?
It's not. And I think there's one company that I know of in Vibe that I think I'm sure you're aware of, because I know Christopher Farina, who you've talked to, he's worked there.
Yep.
But what they do, I think, is the way to do it. If you're going to be using AI and listening tools to impact, you know, summaries and things like that, their listening tool includes the silences, which tells you so much. Mm. So if you're just reviewing a transcript, then you don't get all of those kind of subtle relational dynamics that you can only hear by listening in a true ethnography sense. So hopefully there will be more organizations that are looking at listening tools that are truly listening and not just transcribing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a worry, you know, because obviously large, especially insurance companies, are always pushing for slimming down the workforce and making things more efficient, and putting quotes around the words efficient. And if they think that AI is going to do that, they're going to try to implement it at every place, when in reality, it's just going to make a lot of mistakes and deprive people of the correct care, as we've seen with, you know, as they've tried to implement AI to evaluate insurance claims, and it does a terrible job, and then people suffer.
Yeah. I will say, though, back to the physician conversation I had at ASCO, I feel incredibly I'm very hopeful about the future of medicine. For a variety of reasons. I mean, it's been spread around the internet. There was a minutes long standing ovation at ASCO around some pancreatic cancer data. That's incredible and just gives me goosebumps to think about. I was unfortunately not in the room at the conference, but amazing. But I think, you know, this physician I was talking to, her whole approach is focused on empathy. And I think that we're going to start seeing that a lot more as newer physicians come to be, you know, in their workforce. I think just as a result of, millennials, Gen X and Gen Z now being like the primary healthcare providers in the space. I mean, culturally things are shifting, but I do also feel like there's an increased focus from the physicians that I've talked to on making sure that they really understand where their patient is coming from and make sure that they're using AI tools in ways that are truly beneficial and not taking away. Mm-hmm. She uses something called Open Evidence regularly, which is more of a, like it's an AI LLM tool, but it's more for helping with diagnostics and treatment planning. And she uses it with her patients when her patients consent to that. And then she uses it in front of them and they have a conversation with the AI tool together. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if doctors are going to be using these things, that's the way that I would want it to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's just, the field is very exciting because I do feel, as I've said, there's so much more increased focus on the communication aspect of medicine than there has been in the past, from what I can tell.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, to be clear, I think most doctors, they don't want it.
Most doctors are doing the very best they can with the tools they have. Under systemic constraints a lot of times.
Exactly. Yeah. It's structural, it's systemic, and that's the part that, you know, we all need to be concerned about. But yeah, doctors are awesome when you see all the breakthroughs that are happening and all the new vaccines and cures for diseases that we never thought would be ever cured. And it's like, what a time to be alive. So
yeah, being able to talk to treating physicians on a daily basis, I think, is what gives me the hope in the industry, because I'm not just seeing what's happening at the systemic level. I'm actually talking to doctors who are truly caring for patients and changing lives. It's very exciting to hear that all the time.
That's so uplifting, so amazing. Yeah. So I did want to just, you've gone from position to position, and one thing that still comes up, all these years later, in academia, it's still kind of a different paradigm, right? You're expected to go to a university and then you work there for the rest of your life, right? Yeah. and that's not true in industry. And I still want people to understand that doing what you've done, which is moving from company to company and position to position, is normal, right? Yeah. That's what you do. You don't go and work at a company for the rest of your life. That was the paradigm for, maybe our grandparents, not even our parents anymore. Yeah. And the reason you do that, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but is because you have better opportunities, you get to learn, maybe you make more money. Like, there's a lot of different reasons why you might want to take a different job. Sometimes you get laid off too, but you're not just moving for the sake of moving. Like, there are reasons why you'd want to take a different job at a different company, right? Like, that's been true for you in all these Absolutely. Moves that you've done.
Yeah. I mean, the job at Evergreen kind of just came up, and I loved my job at Ms. Lansky. It was a difficult choice to make, but it was one of those, like, this is the time and I should try this. I'm very glad that I did, because now I have great connections in that field. Even if I don't go back into anything related, they're great people to have met. And, I think a lot of these companies that I've worked at least, they do something very specific. So if you're the sort of person that wants to be really good at one thing, then you can stay there for a long time and have a fantastic time. I'm the kind of person who wants to be pretty good at a lot of things. So I wanted to try new stuff. And so having the opportunity to get new experiences and meet new people is really what has kept me energized and excited. And I will say, I think I've doubled my salary in the last 6 years, maybe, which is not something you can do in academia.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's very important. That's one of the things that the Linguistics Career Launch have talked about a lot, is like, let's normalize talking about our salaries, because again, in academia, that's not supposed to be a thing you ever talk about. So let's talk about it. I'm not saying that to you. I'm just saying in general, we should be pretty open and transparent about it. And that's what, as you're looking for jobs, you need to make people be more transparent about what kind of compensation you're actually going to get and what the benefits are as well. You can't just take a job on a promise like, oh, we'll pay you good. Like, no, you have to know what it's actually going to be, and then you can negotiate to get what you're actually worth.
Yeah. I did take a negotiation class as part of my MBA, which was incredibly valuable.
Awesome.
I would recommend to anyone, if you have the time or ability, to take a course in negotiation, even if it's one of those free ones through Coursera or something like that. Even just thinking about, like, reframing the concept of negotiation to be from splitting the pie to making the pie bigger has changed my way of thinking completely.
Oh.
So it's not about, taking what we have and splitting it up as equitably as possible. It's actually about thinking outside the box and finding ways to make everybody happier. And that has been very helpful for me as I've been thinking about negotiation in a salary context. Like, what outside of the money would add value to my life? Should I ask for more flexible work schedule? Should I ask for more financial stipend for learning and development? I was able to get both companies, Ms. Lansky and Verilog, to help me pay for my MBA as part of this negotiation process. Mm-hmm. I was able to get 3 months of healthcare covered when I got laid off as part of this. So, learning how to frame things in a way that is creating more benefit for the person you're negotiating with also is hugely valuable and a skill that I think linguists inherently have, but potentially feel uncomfortable using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a great recommendation. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Totally agree. We are trained not to negotiate because you don't do it in academia, right? Like you just kind of take what you're given.
Context. Yep. Yeah.
That's incredibly valuable. And I did not know that Coursera had courses on negotiation. So
I assume they do. I said that before looking, but they have stuff on everything. And if they don't, then someone like Harvard Business School probably has a free version of something that you can watch a video at least.
Yeah, for sure. That is really good. So as you're looking back on these, I know you've talked about the different ways that you got into these jobs, some you applied for and some were based on contacts. How has your network grown and how important has your networking been to your career over the years, over the last 10 years?
I would say that my network has been the most important part of all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, the job I'm in now, it was as a result of a client that I had worked with recommending me. But then there also happened to be two or three people from Verilog working at Spherix. So I was able to make that connection and like get myself in a little bit more easily. I find that keeping in touch with people is fun. And networking can be less about kind of keeping in touch with people for a specific reason and more about just keeping them as warm contacts. And I think that goes a really long way, especially, you know, now that I'm in a position where I do have some sales responsibilities, I need to have a network to be able to sell things to people. But even separately from that, being able to learn from folks in so many different areas of business and of the industry that I'm in has been hugely valuable for career exploration too. Mm-hmm. So I have a better sense of like what my clients are doing day to day and would I ever want to work at Johnson & Johnson, for example, maybe not. But having those connections with folks that I've worked with before gives me that kind of view into what they're doing so I can know. And then I can also ask them, do you know anyone? Can you connect me? Mm-hmm. Like I've kept in touch with my old boss from Evergreen, who I mentioned is the chief medical officer at Cigna. He's a great person to know. He knows a lot of people, so just good to keep in touch. I think networking feels a little scary sometimes because it feels like we're trying to, you know, get something out of someone. But I think about it more as like, I don't know, kind of like casual dating almost. just trying to like create a warm, like friendly connection. We might have a little bit of a, you know, flirty, but in a very professional sort of way. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that makes sense. Sort of like back and forth. We're just trying to like be friendly and get to know each other. And then maybe eventually if one of us needs something from each other, you know, it'll be easy to do. I also find that being very willing to make connections for other people has been really valuable because then of course they're willing to do the same for you.
Yeah.
So if anyone reaches out for an informational interview or if they say, you know, I notice you have this connection, can you introduce me? In the instances where I can do that, I always want to. So I'll say that to whoever's listening here too. If I know someone in my LinkedIn network that you want to talk to, reach out and I'll reach out to them for you. Because that's the way that we're going to be successful here is positioning each other in the right way too. Because networking is hugely valuable. I think people in industry don't understand the value of a linguistics background. But if you're able to articulate it properly, their eyes like bug out. Mm-hmm. They get very excited.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for mentioning that because I was going to bring that up to make sure it was okay if I put your LinkedIn link in the show notes for this. So thanks for that. I think what I have seen, and I'm sure you've seen this as well, is that one linguist brings in other linguists, right? Because once people see how valuable linguistics is, like you're a linguist, you bring linguistics to your job, and then they understand it and they're like, oh, linguistics actually is really important. Let's hire some more of those. And, you know, you do your bit evangelizing for linguistics. But once people actually see it, then they understand the value of it and they're more likely to hire more linguists. So one brings in more.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's very easy to frame yourself as a linguist, as a communications specialist. Mm-hmm. Obviously, people study communications and that's a different sort of background, but it's all interlinked. And I think linguistics is just the science of communication, right? So if you're able to call yourself a a scientific communication specialist, then I think your opportunities are huge. Like it's truly just all about framing. But I do think that linguists have an incredibly special mix of skills. And I'm saying that about my colleagues, even potentially more than myself. I've seen some really cool ways of thinking that come out of a linguistics training experience that you don't see from people with different backgrounds just because they're trained to think differently.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. So cool. So I think those are all the questions that I had for you. Is there anything else you wanted to get in before we wrap things up?
I just want to say thanks for this opportunity. I was so incredibly excited to hear from you because I love being a linguist and being professionally in linguistics without being in academia. I think it is very exciting and there are so many opportunities. And I love to be a part of bringing more linguists to industry because I think industry needs it too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I have found that the community of linguists in industry, let me say that correctly, linguists in industry are like the most caring and willing to share and supportive and just, you know, wanting to help other linguists do it. Like everybody is so friendly and so willing to do all the things that you were just talking about, like make recommendations and make connections and everything. It feels like a very small, big world, you know, where we're all sort of connected. And I love that. I think it's great. So whoever you are who are listening, do not be afraid to reach out to other linguists because, you know, 9.5 times out of 10, you're going to get a really positive response and it'll help you on your way.
I'm in Baltimore and I'm in Philly often for work. So if anyone listening is local to those areas, I would also be happy to meet up for coffee or lunch and we can talk more.
Yeah. See, that's all you need to do. Reach out. Do it on LinkedIn. Just send a note. It's great. Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. This has been fantastic.
Thanks, Laurel. It's been great.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held 2 online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.